Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. It's Veterans Day, so we're going to talk about Veterans Day movies. We're also going to talk about Christmas music, it's particularly the worst Christmas songs of all time, since that's already begun. The Christmas music has begun 24 hours a day. So we'll get into that, too. And some of the worst menu items at every chain restaurant that you can talk about. That's all coming up here. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. If you would like to get in here, talk or text, you can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. And it's facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right, it is Monday. That means the Monday morning movie reviews and the box office report will happen. Eric Childress, Steve Procopi join me every Monday morning to talk movies. And let's get the guys in. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Good morning.
All right. Eric, why don't we tell everybody about the screening you're hosting this week of Apocalypse Now, The Final Cut.
Yeah, it's actually a very special screening because this is the brand new, the final cut that Francis Ford Coppola recently reorganized for the 11th time or whatever he's done over the years, which is basically sort of a kind of a bridge between the original version from 1979 and the Redux version that he did in 2011. So it's the final cut that runs just over 3 hours long. It's the first time it's ever been played at the Oak Grove Cinema here in the suburbs, and I will be hosting that screening Wednesday night at Oak Grove Cinema at 7 p.m.
Okay, 7 p.m. Wednesday night at Elk Grove Cinema, and that's Apocalypse Now, the final. How many cuts have there been of that?
Three official ones, I think. I think he's tweaked some things over the years, and he might have done some, like, he's done a lot of sound revisions. I know Walter Murch has worked on the film quite a bit. But as far as actual cuts are concerned, I think this is now like the third official cut that he's done.
Does it include the French the French scene that just goes on forever?
Yeah, I hope not, is my short answer. Because that's the moment when I saw the movie, the Redux version of Ebertfest a few years ago.
Yeah.
I think that's the moment where I fell asleep.
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, it's just...
It's unbearable, kind of.
Oh, my God.
But the movie, I mean, I think the movie, I've seen two different running times for it, so I'll even have to check and see exactly how long it runs. But, you know, anything that can bridge those two versions, I'm certainly cool with.
Very cool.
Yeah.
All right, so
wait,
it's Wednesday.
Is it shorter than Redux, then?
Yes.
It is, okay.
Yes. I saw originally 3 hours and 2 minutes.
Okay.
The theater's advertising is 3 hours and 23 minutes, so I have to double-check what the actual running time is.
Okay.
This is on Blu-ray already, though, right? This is the one that came out.
It came out in
recently.
August, yeah. It came out in a 4K version. It was released, I think it came out in Chicago in like one theater.
Huh.
For a week or a weekend or something
that.
But
all right.
Most people did.
Okay.
So yeah, we've had this in the works for quite a while because it debuted at Tribeca, I think.
Hmm.
That's where he debuted it, and then it was coming out on Blu-ray in August.
All right. Well, there you go. See it on the big screen. Apocalypse Now, Final Cut, one night only, Elk Grove Cinema, and Eric is hosting it. Very cool.
Sam.
All right. Steve.
Yes.
Man, playing with fire. Let's hear it.
Oh. Am I the only one?
You are the only one,
oh,
my
yeah,
friend.
Baby.
You cowards. All right.
Yeah.
Too scared of a little smoke jumping, especially in today's burning California
title.
Climate. All right. So okay, let me just preface this by saying that less than a week before I saw this sort of oppressively PG-rated kids movie, I was fortunate enough to catch John Leguizamo performing his latest one-man show in Chicago, in which he sort of champions putting Latino history in school textbooks and letting kids of all nationalities see people that look like them be a part of history. So imagine my shock and horror in seeing him clowning around in Playing with Fire as a member of a rugged crew of firefighters known as smoke jumpers. They literally parachute or are lowered directly into a fire situation to help rescue people or put out the fire at its core. And just so I'm clear, everybody in the movie is clowning around, not just Leguizamo, but To have just seen him do something so incredible, it just made it hurt all the more to see this movie. The film centers on a by-the-book station superintendent named Jake Carlson, who's played by John Cena, who's still gigantic, in case you were worried. His father died on the job, which gives him sort of more respect for the job and why the letter of the law has to be recognized in his house. The cast of other firefighters includes Leguizamo, Keegan-Michael Key, and Tyler Mane, who plays a nearly silent character named Axe, and that's because he carries an axe all the time, and that's about the level of humor we're dealing with here. So they all play sort of his faithful underlings who are dedicated and but still wish their fearless leader would have more of a life outside the station, and he nearly did not long before when he went on a couple dates with the a local biologist played by Judy Greer, but he kind of panicked when he realized how much he liked her and wanted to avoid any personal connections because he was afraid it would distract him from his work, and that's kind of how he thinks his father died because he was too busy thinking about the family. Anyway, so on one rescue mission, the team saved these three kids in a burning cabin, and because it happens at the end or at the beginning of a weekend, they have to take care of the kids through the weekend until the parents come back. The great Brianna Hillebrand, who's in the Deadpool movies and Tragedy Girls, she plays the oldest kid who's being a little shifty about where her parents are exactly, and she's trying to wrangle her brother and younger sister long enough to get out of, like, escape the firehouse without anyone noticing, but the two young ones are too busy alternating between causing chaos and being adorable. So as if there weren't enough going on this particular weekend, the rescue of the kids has put Jake in the spotlight with the fire department commander, who's played by Dennis Haysbert, and as a possible candidate for his job when he retires. So he's planning a visit to the station that seems very badly timed with when these kids are supposed to leave, and one can only wonder if something terrible is going to happen. So I kept looking at the names in this cast and being kind of astonished that the talent collected here is so unbelievably wasted. And these are some of, like, the best improvisers among, like, comedy actors right now. And the fact that they could produce something so tragically unfunny just killed me. The director, Andy Sickman, who did You Again and Race to Witch Mountain, adds absolutely nothing to the comic mix with his sort of limp sense of what's funny and beyond just making faces and screaming and overplaying every allegedly humorous line. It actually hurt my heart a little, especially to see Greer in the middle of this mess because, I mean, she's playing a lovesick woman who's easily the smartest person in the room in any given moment, but is still saddled with playing surrogate mom to these awful children. If there is any redeeming quality to playing with fire, ask no one, or is there? I should say no one that really cares, but I'll admit that there are a collection of outtakes that play during the end credits that might be the only thing I laughed out loud during the entire film, and most of those moments come because of Keegan-Michael Key, who's really the only person in this movie that even came close to making me laugh during the actual movie. I happen to think John Cena is actually a pretty reliably funny guy on film, and you know, and you can look at Blockers or look at Trainwreck and see that, but his take on this man torn between duty and living a fulfilling life is sort of stiff and humorless, and it's made all the worse, and I'll keep emphasizing this, by these usually very funny people just sort of floundering around him. So this one damaged my soul a little bit.
Yeah, my God. I mean, you're right. I mean, I happen to like John Cena too. I think he can be effective and charming and funny. But man, I just saw the trailer for this thing and I was like, what? First of all, what the hell is Keegan-Michael Key doing?
Maybe he's making money. I mean,
yeah,
I guess.
I mean, oh man, I don't know. You know,
Cena's not just like. I mean, he's not just funny. He's not just unfunny in this movie. He's legitimately bad. The character he has chosen, the way he's chosen to play this, is bad. It's not just not funny. It's painful. Like, it's like, this is not him. This is not the guy. There's no charm. There's no, like, self-awareness of how, like, ridiculous he looks in that setting. So it's terrible.
Okay. All right.
And which firefighter was named Axe, Steve?
Tyler Mane.
Okay, because that's also Scott Glenn's nickname in Backdraft.
God, I don't even remember that. Okay, guys, hang on.
Okay.
All right, Eric, Steve, they're hanging on. We're going to take a break for the news. When we come back, more Monday Morning Movie Reviews right here on 720 WGN. Everybody, Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here on a Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about Veterans Day movies, worst items on every chain restaurant's menu, and Christmas songs, some of the worst. We're going to talk about the worst Christmas songs right here on 720 WGN. And right now it's box office and movie reviews. The Monday Morning Movie Reviews continue. Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me to talk movies. Let's get the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
All right. Eric, tell us about Going Attractions, the definitive story of the movie Palace. By the way, April Wright, the director, is going to be on the show tomorrow.
Yeah, so Steve will provide some more information about the screening that is taking place this week. But this is it's a documentary about, as the title says, the history of the movie theater, most importantly, the movie palaces, where people used to gather as, you know, motion pictures really sort of hit the zeitgeist and became a phenomenon and a thing for people to go out and make an evening out of. This movie traces the history of where these movie palaces originated, talking about their architecture and their sort of glorious place in history. And as the film sort of began, as the first few minutes of the movie, I felt like I was sort of in the wave of what seemed to be, I would basically call theatrical propaganda, given that, you know, everything that we're talking about today regarding where where the history of movie theaters are going as far as streaming and Netflix and all these things that are going on, it seemed like, I was in store for something that was just going to be an hour and a half of reminding us, ooh, look at this, what these great places were, and, can't we, go back to this, this sort of bygone era, which is a criticism that, a lot of people talk about as far as the theatrical experience is concerned. But this movie then really sort of evolves into a really kind of rich history about the history of movie theaters in general and where they had to change and they had to alter themselves, not just through television, but just other forms of cinema, including Cinerama and other things that they were doing to keep themselves in business, and then going all the way right through into the multiplexes and the current era we live in. And as I was watching the movie, I found myself more and more drawn in to this history. Not that I didn't know a lot of the stuff that was being presented to me, but I kept thinking to myself that if I was teaching a film class currently, I would have set up a field trip to go see the screening that's going to be taking place at the Music Box this week, because I think that the people that need to see this are not necessarily the three of us. We are very familiar with a lot of the things that are talked about during this movie. But it is, this rich reminder of how these movie palaces or the theatrical experience, to just use another term for it, have evolved and has survived. There's a moment of a montage in this movie that's amongst the saddest things I've seen all year, which is sort of pictures and photos of how these movie palaces have been destroyed, have been let go. Some of them actually video of showing actual demolishment of some of them, and it's so sad to to watch. You think about people who love the drive-in experience so much, which is also another thing that kind of moved people away from these great movie theaters. And now the drive-in is pretty much gone the way of the dodo. But the theatrical experience has still survived, and it is still adapting. It is putting in new seats and assigned seating and all these things to sort of draw people back. And I think that a movie like this particular documentary, it would seem ironic, even just watching it the way I did at home on my television, when a movie like this, would be, particularly to people that don't know a lot of this information, I would be hard pressed not to to miss it at the Music Box Theater this week. This movie really kind of surprised me how much I really enjoyed it.
Okay, all right, Steve, tell us a little more.
Yeah, Eric's not kidding. Like, there were a couple moments I started tearing up in that exact section Eric's talking about, where you just see these dilapidated places that have been empty or even worse, torn down. It's really kind of heartbreaking as a movie fan to see that. And, we get it. Like, it just wasn't economical to keep these places going. But when you get glimpses of a couple theaters in Chicago in particular that are in various stages of restoration, including the Uptown, which is in much better shape than I thought it was, even though they still have a couple years to go on it. And then another one on the south side, called the New Regal, I think, which I've never seen before. But this place, I mean, looks like an opera house, and it's stunning. I don't think it's reopened yet, but it looks like the restoration's done. And it's just like, it's not just a film about Chicago, obviously, and it's kind of cool to see that there are still places in this country, well, mainly New York and L.A., where they still have like a strip of theaters. They're not all palaces, but it's like Chicago doesn't really have that anymore. And we haven't for as long as I lived here, at least. But it's kind of just incredible to see, not that long ago, and some of these places adapted and they became adult film theaters, or some of them became churches, and some of them, but at least like they're at least kept alive to a certain degree. I should mention the director, April Wright, her last, I think last feature film, maybe this is going to be, you can ask her this tomorrow, Nick. She's got a couple films called Going Attractions. The first one was about drive-ins. It was about the definitive story of the American drive-in that she made like 5 or 6 years ago. But yeah, so these are like, these things are really precious to her. It's kind of, and they really don't even talk that much about the movies that played there. It's mostly about the things surrounding the movies, like between the like thousands of seats and these curved screens and these exotic interiors, and even the bathrooms were ornate, and most importantly, of course, the air conditioning back in the day when private homes didn't have air conditioning, so that was like a huge thing, which I'm guessing a lot of people don't know. And I did learn things about. There's a funny little, Eric, do you remember that funny little thing about why the marquees, or why the Blade
lettering
marquees are different in Chicago than they are everywhere else?
That is so Chicago.
I know.
That's so Chicago.
So, yeah, I won't ruin that surprise, but it's very funny why our Blade marquees are different than the rest of the world. So, anyway, it's a fantastic little film, and Chicago is well represented in it. So,
yeah, I'm going to have her on tomorrow, and I'm going to watch the movie before, obviously, interview her. I haven't watched it yet, but I grew up going to those theaters downtown. That was that's how I saw movies. They were kind of grindhouses at that point. They were not in the best shape, but there were like 15 movie theaters within a 5-block radius in the loop, and it was glorious. I saw them in the 70s. Like I said, and it was mostly exploitation movies and stuff like that that I saw. But those experiences shaped me. And I loved those theaters. I absolutely loved those theaters. So,
and Nick, like I'm sure Steve as well, you could probably remember every single movie you saw where you saw that.
Absolutely, no question about it.
One moment in the movie where one of the talking heads says, "I don't remember all the movies I saw there, but I certainly remember like the architecture." I'm like, "Oh, come on!"
I can tell you off. Like in the 70s, I can tell you exactly what theater I saw those movies in. The first one that popped into my head. Saw the original Black Christmas at the Roosevelt.
Yep.
I got it. All right. You guys hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wait, right. Hey, Nick, we should mention the film is playing on Tuesday night.
Oh,
this coming Tuesday at 7 o'clock at the Music Box.
Okay, Tuesday
and the director
night.
Will be there, and a bunch of other people who are connected with the Uptown and this new Regal are going to be
great.
There, too.
So, cool. So that's Going Attractions, the definitive story of movie palaces. Director April Wright will be there Tuesday night at the Music Box, mm-hmm. and she'll be on my show tomorrow. Okay, mm-hmm. guys, hang on. There you go.
Yeah.
Eric and Steve are going to hang on. We're going to take a quick break. We got more Monday morning movie reviews to do right after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline studio. It's Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey-jokey time. We're doing the Monday morning movie reviews and much more. We're here till 5 a.m. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk or text. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi join me every Monday morning to review the new movies, and Eric sticks around. We talk box office. We're going to do that. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
All right. Let's see. All right. Eric, tell us about The Irishman.
Okay. We're jumping right into
right
this.
In.
Yep.
this is the latest film from Martin Scorsese, and it tells the story of Frank Sheeran, played by Robert De Niro, who was a veteran of the of World War II. As we first meet him in a nursing home, as he is going to tell us his tale of doing hits for the mob. He was a delivery man, a truck driver, and he got himself kind of ingratiated with a chance encounter with a mobster played by Joe Pesci, and he ends up kind of being interested in being a part of this world, and offers to sell them the stuff off his truck, the kind of things that we saw many times over in a lot of Scorsese films, particularly Goodfellas. But Frank is just very, very earnest. He's very good at his job. And sort of rises amongst the trust within the mob in Pennsylvania, and he then becomes acquainted with Jimmy Hoffa, who is played by Al Pacino, and they sort of strike up a friendship. He becomes not just a confidant, but almost like a bodyguard to him throughout his time, as he's doing his backhanded while representing the Brotherhood of Teamsters and fighting on behalf of the unions. He also had many dealings with the mob itself, and in dealing with other rising mobsters at the time, trying to maintain his position over time. So this sprawling sort of epic takes us through multiple decades and a period of history that I'm incredibly fascinated with. There's even a pretty amazing shout out to JFK in the film, delivered by no less than Joe Pesci himself. This is exactly what as advertised. The sort of the glowing praise that we've been hearing about The Irishman since it debuted at the New York Film Festival. All 3.5 hours of it, and not a wasted minute in it. The film, in many ways, kind of plays like a encapsulation of Scorsese's career. We see not just sort of the old gang brought together with De Niro and Pesci, and Harvey Keitel shows up in the movie. This big giant cast and a sprawling cast in the film, but it's easy to sort of get lumped into the film or Scorsese sort of playing his greatest hits, which he's been accused of in the past with films like Casino and maybe even The Departed a little bit, but. He takes it into a much different direction. The first sort of half of the movie is that they kind of, the Scorsese hits, if you will, that you're going into, that you might be expecting, you're going to get during the first half of the movie. And then the second half of the movie gets, maybe even the last third of the film, gets a lot more introspective, and we sort of, you know, sort of really dig into the Sheeran's the sort of the sense of the whatever accomplishments that he's been achieving throughout his life, he's actually lost so much more, and his reflection of that cost him not only friendships but the love of his family, particularly his daughter, played later in the film in kind of a really kind of exquisite performance by Anna Paquin. And it's there's so much to talk about this movie that, you know, between the three of us, I think we can pretty much cover only a fraction of it. And it's the kind of movie that you're going to want to see more than once. And it sounds might sound like a daunting task at 3.5 hours, but like I said, this is a movie that just holds you in its grip through that entire time. It is funny. It is incredibly sad at times. De Niro gives one of his best performances in years. There's a scene where he has to deliver news on a phone call. That might be the best thing he's done in decades. Al Pacino doing some of the best work of his career. Joe Pesci doing some of the best work of his career. I could go on and on throughout the cast because everyone in the movie is that good. And yeah, I mean, for people who want to believe in the story, this is a purportedly true story about the events surrounding what happened to Jimmy Hoffa, even more so than the David Mamet, Danny DeVito version of events. And you know, you can believe it if you want or not believe it, but it's nevertheless it's a fascinating yarn that ultimately comes off as a really, really sad tale.
Okay. All right, Steve, what do you think?
Yeah, the first half is a lot of fun. The second half is the reason the movie is a masterpiece. In a lot of ways, The Irishman is meant to be like an alternative look at American history in the back half of the 20th century, where the world outside is kind of moving along and sort of blissfully ignorant, and these crime families are finding ways to make money illegally, but also keeping things running and keeping the country going, and in ways that like normal folks wouldn't even notice. But eventually, like, the government noticed and began like enthusiastically going after Hoffa and these other people. There's some fascinating trends in The Irishman in terms of the acting, where like it's kind of wonderful how the older veteran actors, for the most part, for most of the film, play these roles really like with a reserve, that sort of less is more thing. And like, especially for someone like Pesci or even Harvey Keitel, that's like, you don't see that very often in those guys, and it really is wonderful. But meanwhile, the younger guys playing these sort of younger gangsters like Bobby Cannavale and Stephen Graham and Sebastian Maniscalco are all playing their roles like they grew up watching gangster movies. So like they're like playing the gangster role, and they have no sense that calling attention to themselves is terrible for business. Yeah, and like Eric said, the movie spends a lot of time with these families of these men, and we begin to get a sense pretty early on that that they all, like, a lot of them had to pay a price with these families because their fathers are part of these worlds, and they aren't around much, and they have strange hours, and they can't talk about their work like dads do at the dinner table. And it's a distancing and isolated existence. And in that film's third act, man, it really opens up the part of the mob movie that I have never seen before, that kind of aftermath and the way that Frank ends up in this like assisted living place. It really, and he's telling us the story, like out loud, he's telling us the story. And you wonder like what happens to elderly gangsters? Like that's, when do you ever see that? And in anything but like a comedy, and De Niro's performance in these last few scenes is exquisite, and it taps into an aspect of this lifestyle that is there's no shiny suits or jewelry or the finer things in life. And man, I mean, The Irishman is brilliantly acted and executed, but it's this sort of fresh take on one of the oldest genres in film history that like I said, makes it a masterpiece.
Yeah. Okay, guys, hang on. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a break. We'll come back. I'll tell you what I thought of The Irishman, Scorsese's latest movie, after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here on a Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And right now we're doing the Monday morning movie reviews. Eric and Steve always join me to talk about the movies, and then Eric sticks around to do the box office. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
Before the break, Eric and Steve raved about The Irishman, and I'm going to rave about it, too. it is a great film, and it runs 3.5 hours long. Everybody knows that. There's not a wasted frame in it. It's Scorsese firing on all cylinders. Everybody involved, as far as performances go, is great. So it's like, you know, you guys both said it's one of De Niro's best performances. I mean, in years, he dove in head first in this. And man, Pesci, it's just been. When was the last time Joe Pesci was in a movie?
The Good Shepherd, I think.
Man, it's been too long, and he is so great in this. But not just the big three. You know what I mean? De Niro, Pacino, Pesci.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's great in this movie, top to bottom. I'm glad you guys mentioned Anna Paquin, because she's amazing in it. And this is an epic movie on every scale, on every level, covering so much history and so much ground, going beyond some of the gangster stuff that we've always associated Scorsese with. It's amazing how fresh this movie is. You know what I mean? Considering how many mob movies Scorsese has made. And how many essential mob movies that he's made. You know, like when you think mob movies, immediately you think of Scorsese. At least for me, it would be Scorsese then Coppola. But this is as definitive a historical mob movie as The Godfather was. It's up on that level. This is a classic. This is you know, years from now we're going to be talking about this movie as we in the same way that we revere The Godfather and movies like that and Goodfellas. This is as good as that. I encourage people to see it on the big screen, and I hope that people will go out and see it on the big screen.
I feel bad if you don't.
Yeah,
to be honest.
Yeah,
like,
but
honestly.
I mean, it is going to be on Netflix at the end of the month. But this is a movie that deserves to be seen on the biggest screen possible, not your television. So while some people might not want to go out and see it and watch it on Netflix, okay, you watch it on Netflix. It's still a great, great, great movie. But you'll miss out on seeing a really, truly cinematic experience from one of the great directors of all time and some of the best acting that you'll ever see. This is a great film, a great film. So there you go. All right. Now moving on, Eric, Steve, tell us about Midway.
Oh, okay.
Oh, wait, Eric, I'm sorry, Eric.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, this is Roland Emmerich's new film, Midway, which is, for people who don't know, is a very historic battle that took place not too long after Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, and by the way, it was made into a movie in the 70s in Sensoround.
That's correct. correct.
And I saw it in Sensoround.
Yeah, I was hoping to see that again. I hadn't seen that movie in God knows how long before I saw this, just to compare the two. But I was going in to see a Roland Emmerich movie, so you know, not a lot of movies compare to that. But anyway, but as the movie begins a few years before the World War II, you know, Patrick Wilson is talking to one of the Japanese leaders, and basically a warning is sort of put forth that if you know the Japanese oil supply is threatened in any way, that it might lead to an attack. Fast forward not too long later, and we get to witness Roland Emmerich's version of Pearl Harbor. We already saw Michael Bay do it in 2001. So why not give us the understudy of Roland Emmerich doing it himself? And obviously, so then this movie begins with Pearl Harbor and then takes us into the events afterwards as the American military and military intelligence try to figure out what their next moves are going to be. Obviously, the infamous attack that drew us into World War II, and they begin looking for not just retaliation, which comes a bit in the form of the Doolittle raids. The Doolittle is played by Aaron Eckhart in this movie in a very, very kind of small role. Woody Harrelson plays General or Admiral Nimitz, who is tasked and put in charge of the sprawling event that's going on. And Patrick Wilson is still there, who warned the American military and intelligence that the Pearl Harbor was very possible, and he was ignored, but he's determined not to be ignored again when they begin trying to figure out these mysterious coded messages that are coming through that are leading to what Washington thinks is an attack somewhere else. And Patrick Wilson's character has determined that it's going to be an attack on Midway. So we have, very much like Michael Bay's Pearl Harbor, we have, again, a large cast of characters, from the fighter pilots to naval officers to the intelligence officers and the military leaders. Dennis Quaid plays Admiral Halsey, and just like I said, Woody Harrelson and Patrick Wilson. Ed Skrein plays sort of the Tom Cruise Maverick pilot who is, he's always breaking the rules and doing everything so dangerous that he's going to get himself or other pilots killed. Luke Evans plays his superior who doesn't like what he does. Mandy Moore plays Maverick's wife, so to speak. And so we have a Roland Emmerich Pearl Harbor / Midway film. And more so, while I was watching this movie, I could not escape thinking how much this movie was literally like watching a video game. It's a metaphor that gets used a lot when we talk about movies that deal with a lot of things that blow up and special effects and things like that. But this very much felt like watching yourself play a video game where you play one of the fighter pilots, and all the stuff that's in between the battle sequences in this movie feel exactly like those perfunctory scenes in video games where characters come on, explain to you exactly what's going to be happening, so you get to the next action point. It all feels like this perfunctory, expository dialogue that you just keep wanting to skip to get to the battle sequences, except the battle sequences, once you've sort of gotten to basically the second or even third of these sequences, they all just kind of feel the same. Some of the special effects in these sequences are pretty subpar. There's not a lot of strategy that where we come to really learn exactly why the pilots and why the attacks were carried out in certain respects. It's just a lot of planes dive bombing and shooting at stuff. I couldn't tell one battle sequence apart from the next. So it all just got incredibly repetitive, and the more repetitive it got, the duller the entire thing out, which is not the kind of thing that you expect out of a war movie. I mean, I'm certainly no defender of Pearl Harbor, but at least the Pearl Harbor sequence in that movie, at least the first 20 minutes of it, are pretty expertly done as far as crafting a visual effects visualization of what it might have been like at that time. And that was, almost 20 years ago now. The technology should be a lot better for Emmerich to do his version, and this movie cost $100 million too, so there is money certainly spent on this thing. I just don't think it was spent well at all. Emmerich's certainly not the guy to be, he's blown up a lot of stuff throughout his career. He doesn't really have the chops to do the human aspect. With like Independence Day, the cast work was all kind of broad and funny, and yet strangely more identifiable than the characters in this movie. You could see Wilson and Harrelson and Quaid basically getting to show up for a couple weeks and just spend on a couple of sets and say their dialogue, and then they got to go home while the fighter pilots had to deal with all these special effects and things like that, and all of them are duller than dishwater. There's really not a lot for me to recommend here with Emmerich's Midway.
All right, guys, hang on.
Yep.
Okay.
All right. Eric and Steve are going to hang on. That was Eric's review of Midway. We'll come back. We'll find out what Steve thought of Midway on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews here on 720 WGN. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday and it's a jokey time. Got a Blackhawks Express to play back, a good one from last night's game. Right now we're talking about the movie reviews. It's the Monday morning movie reviews with Eric and Steve. And before the break, Eric told us about Midway, and now we're going to find out. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back. Now we'll find out what Steve thought of it. I did not see it. So, Steve, tell us about what you thought.
Yeah, I mean, one thing you can always count on from Roland Emmerich films is scale. And while there are also likely to be explosions in, like Eric said, giant casts, the guy doesn't skimp on making every story kind of epic, whether it needs to be or not. And I don't think Midway is any exception. But with a lot of large-scale films, what sacrifices intimacy and the more personal stories that often breathe life into movies about, you know, spaceship battles or war or worldwide weather events or natural disasters or whatever Emmerich is doing. I feel like this film does a better job with it than most of his films. It dives into the personal lives of some of these people. I like what Mandy Moore was adding to it, and I almost feel like she's doing it despite Roland Emmerich in some scenes, but at least she's doing it. And she's sort of brought to the forefront more than I'm used to seeing in a lot of war movies. The stuff between Ed Skein and Luke Evans, that they kind of, their little fights are interesting, and they're usually about strategy, but they overcome them to, like, kind of pull it together for the greater good, which I think is kind of what the whole movie's about, especially put out on Veterans Day weekend. And, you know, obviously there's not going to be a film coming out over Veterans Day weekend that's going to, about this turning point battle that's going to risk ruffling any feathers about, like, how the American Navy people acted. But it does, like, find these moments to show that not everyone was in agreement every step of the way. And I actually thought that the sort of step-by-step process of preparing for the Battle of Midway on both a larger and smaller scale, with Wilson being sort of the primary voice of the brass and Ed's screen as the mouthpiece for the fighter pilots, worked, was actually pretty good. I mean, he's playing a real character. The guy, there's an actor named Luke Kleintank that plays his best friend, who's also a real person. A lot of the people in this are real people. I got to say, Dennis Quaid, as much as I love seeing him in anything, he's basically just playing a walking rash in this movie, and it's gross. And I kind of wish he hadn't been in this movie. I wasn't bothered by the special effects at all, to be honest. And I thought he also did a very good job of keeping this sort of geography of every battle pretty straight. And while it's not, he's not always successful, I think he got it right more often than he didn't. And another, maybe the most interesting thing about Midway is how much time they spend learning about the Japanese side of the equation. It's not nearly as much as the American side, but it's sort of interesting to watch how their military miscalculated and underestimated the U.S. defenses at certain points, at certain key points. And the film is dedicated to both the American and the Japanese soldiers that fought at Midway, and I think that's an important thing to note. It's a useful addition to telling, like, a complete tale, I think, and it's sort of something that you don't get in a lot of war movies. It's certainly a very flawed film in a lot of ways, especially when it kind of pushes the patriotism angle a little too hard. But if, you know, if ever there was a battle that deserved to sort of underscore a few of the brave, it's this one. I think it's one of his better films. It's still not that great, but it's a mild recommendation.
Okay. All right. Well, Steve, why don't you tell us about Last Christmas?
All right. Now we're really going to throw cold water on it. All right. So Emilia Clarke from Game of Thrones plays Kate, who is a young woman and a frustrated Londoner whose life appears to be a series of bad decisions, both in her work and her personal life. She works as an elf for a year-round Christmas store run by Michelle Yeoh, who goes by the name Santa for a ridiculous reason, and is a bit of a taskmaster. Kate's family life is kind of a mess with their overbearing mother. They all come from, I believe it's Yugoslavia. Her mother's played by Emma Thompson with a ridiculously bad accent, I think. She also has a sister who's a lesbian that's afraid to come out to their parents or even admit that she lives with her girlfriend. And apparently, Kate had a severe health issue not too long ago, which, shockingly enough, may come into play later in the film. So, seemingly by chance, she meets a sort of spirited, handsome man named Tom, who's played by Henry Golding from Crazy Rich Asians, as is Michelle Yeoh, outside her office, or outside her job, and her life takes a new turn, perhaps almost too good to be true, as they go on a series of sort of adventurous, decidedly chaste dates. Last Christmas is sort of a blur of side plots, too, that involve this sort of extended supporting cast, as well as Kate and Tom's budding romance, if that's really what it is, in a screenplay written by Emma Thompson, or co-written by Emma Thompson. There's a point in the film about halfway in which a local homeless shelter kind of takes center stage in Kate's life, and as much as the film is clearly about what it takes for people to become better human beings, it seems regrettably shallow the way that they handle it. There are strange references to Brexit through this movie and how immigrants are being treated that are sort of tossed in for the reaction and then never really addressed again. And as you probably have heard or maybe even guessed on your own, there is a twist in the film. I could tell just from the trailer that there was something wonky about the Tom character, and I've seen online that a lot of people even sort of positively identified the nature of this twist, even though they didn't really have all the details, and that's kind of where I landed by the time I sat down to watch this. And there just comes a certain point in Last Christmas, though, where if you haven't figured out more or less what's really going on, I question your powers of deduction. Or maybe you just grew up with lead paint on your walls or something. I don't know. And then there's the George Michael / Wham music, which I have no complaints about. You know, Michael is very popular in the United States, but he is massive in the UK. So some of the song choices might not even be that well known to Americans. There's even an unreleased song that plays over the end credits, which is kind of nice. Kate seems maybe too young to have grown up on George Michael, as she claims, but that's we can save that for another time. It's great. It's weird, and I kind of dig that this sort of weird trend that's going on now of non-biopics that have single artist songs in it. Like, I'm not including like Rocket Man, but like Yesterday and Blinded by the Light. I'm not sure I understand it, but it's fine with me. I like the music. The film is directed by Paul Feig, which it doesn't feel like it is. This feels like a British film, and there's almost no signs of his like sense of humor in this. I had this weird feeling he was like a director for hire for something that was already put together when he got to it. It's not something he worked on from the ground up. But this is a Christmas movie. So the question is this something you would ever revisit? Would you revisit it every holiday season? If the answer is yes, then maybe it's good. It certainly has it's a warm and inviting film. The leads are definitely charming. Even the street where the store is, like, I wanted to walk down that street because it looked really endearing. And thankfully, the twist isn't what the film is ultimately all about. But being honest, I can't imagine ever watching this movie again. The comedy feels way too safe. The romance is perhaps deliberately cold, and the whole thing just didn't connect with me in the way either a rom-com would or a Christmas movie should. So right. That is no for me.
Okay. Guys, hang on.
Yeah.
All right. Eric and Steve talking about the new movies, and we'll find out what Eric thought of Last Christmas and what I thought of Last Christmas after we break. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It's Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke and much more. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And right now, we're doing the Monday morning movie reviews with Eric Childress and Steve Procopi. Let's get back to it. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
Before the break, Steve told us about Last Christmas. Eric, what did you think?
This is really odd because listening to Steve's review of it, I think I actually like the movie more than Steve, but at the same time, there are elements of it that I strenuously dislike even more than he did. there's a lot of weird things about this movie. The weirdest might be that she's such a George Michael fan, yet her ringtone is Fine Young Cannibals.
Right. Well, wait. Her ringtone for her mom specifically.
For her mother, yeah.
Oh, for her mother.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. I never use that feature, so I always forget you do that. But whatever. Okay. I think the first act of the movie, I was like, I heard a lot of really negative things about it, and the twist that was coming, and all these kind of things that people have been trying to guess for months and stuff. But like the first act of the movie, I was like surprisingly with. I think that if you are looking for a bit of Paul Feig sensibilities, I think it's all in the first act of the movie. I think there are some elements about the Christmas store and some of the things that are being sold there that I think are really kind of in line with his sort of the type of humor that you're used to from him. You know, this is a PG-13 movie, and he's done mostly R-rated films. But the beginning of the movie, like Emilia Clarke, who everyone clearly knows from Game of Thrones, and we haven't seen a whole lot of on the big screen. I was a couple years ago. She did a movie called Me Without You or Me Before You. Yes. I forget the name of the movie. But the movie that I kind of ultimately liked because I thought that she was like terrific in that movie, and so I've been really looking forward to seeing her in something again. And in this movie, I mean, I think she has enough charm in this movie to fill up, another six Christmas rom-coms. I was willing to follow her character and all of her flaws throughout, this film. Early on, her chemistry with Henry Golding, I think, is very solid. But then the movie does start to kind of lose its way. Like I think, like the very first sort of or the first couple meetings between her and the Tom character, I think are very nicely done. I think that there's they're going for almost like a Richard Curtis type sensibility, and they're really trying to play this in a kind of a Love Actually realm. Emma Thompson clearly has seen that movie a few times, let alone being in it. But it seems like her screenplay and, like you said, Steve, Paul Feig's handling of it are kind of at odds with each other. And Paul Feig did seem like he almost wanted, like he realized he had an Emma Thompson screenplay and he just wanted to get, out of the way of it when he should have found ways to fix it. And one thing that is such a flaw in the movie is this, this big reveal that's eventually coming down the path. And like you said, Steve, it's not something that's hard to figure out. And I think Paul Feig knows that too, because he's dropping clues like wildfire throughout this movie, almost like signal flags, going, "Hey, stupid, this is what's happening here." But leaving it the reveal so long towards the end of the movie really does a massive disservice to this film. If the film had begun there, at least we could reconcile that aspect very early on, and then we could really get a little bit more drawn in to her character and this relationship that she has with Tom. Instead, it's left as this sort of rug-pulling moment that I think is just ultimately just incredibly cruel. Like, I felt just, like, terrible once this was revealed, even though I knew that it was coming. And so, like, the final, 20 minutes of the movie, as everyone's sort of reconciling all this stuff, and you start to think back on what this reveal ultimately means for her character, and it leads you down some really weird and, you know, potentially dark paths. And it's you know, I'm a big fan of just Christmas in general. So I like Christmas movies. I like Christmas themed stuff. I love the Christmas store. I would shop there all the time. I love
that store. That store.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I will say also that I love the little subplot involving Michelle Yeoh and the mystery man that keeps coming into her store. I loved every time that happened. I smile. I thought that was really funny. But ultimately, you know, I'm not the guy that, you know, that gets all sad during the holidays, because it's actually my favorite holiday. I felt really sad at the end of this movie, and not in a good way, not in a way that was making me think about my life or anything. I just felt really bad for everyone, all the characters involved in this movie, and what especially Kate and what she ultimately has to go through, and also for Emilia Clarke, because she is so charming in this movie that I wish that Emma Thompson had given her a better screenplay.
Yeah. All right. I agree with you about Emilia Clarke. She's lovely and charming and carries the weight of the movie. But I thought that the scenes between her and Henry Golding at first were charming and kind of funny, and she carries the whole movie. It's a mess. The movie's a mess. It's all over the place. It's a total
mess.
She has
a great singing voice, too. We should add that.
Absolutely.
Because that's important.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And she's lovely to watch. And
yeah.
She's, you know, every moment with her on screen I was happy about. But this movie is an absolute mess. And I did not know. You guys were saying that the people were talking about there was a twist in this movie. I didn't know. I didn't read anything about this movie before I saw it. I had no idea that there was going to be a twist. And when it happened, I was like, what? It was like, what? And so basically, at the end of the movie, you find out, what, is she a lunatic? Is she a crazy person?
Right.
I mean, what are we talking about here? So it's absurd. It's completely absurd, and there was no need for it. I didn't see Feig's fingerprints on this at all, and I thought it was just virtually a waste of time. I love the fact that they used George Michael's music, but I think, especially in one scene, it's one of the most inappropriate songs for a romantic scene. They play Praying for Time while they're having this lovely little ice skating date. Praying for Time is basically about the end of the world. It's one of the saddest songs. It's one of the saddest songs George Michael has ever written. And I'm like, why are they playing this song now during what is supposed to be this romantic ice skating thing?
Because it's foreshadowing, Nick.
Oh, man. Well, anyway, it's just the movie's an absolute mess. Yeah, the movie's an absolute mess. But it's a waste for Emilia Clarke, who I want to see in something much better. So. There you
and
go.
The likelihood is we're going to see her more in movies, more movies like this going forward.
Yeah.
So hopefully they'll get better as they
yeah.
go on.
I mean, I never watched Game of Thrones. I stopped after like four episodes in the first season, but I have seen her on talk shows and I've seen her, you know, elsewhere. And I loved her in the movie, and I think she's great. The movie's not.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, you guys, hang on.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric and Steve are going to hang on. When we come back, we got one more movie to review, and it's Stephen King's latest adaptation of Doctor Sleep. So that's coming up. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio, and we got the movie reviews here. One more to review. Let's get the guys back. Here's Eric on WGN. Hey, Eric.
Hello.
And Steve.
Hello.
All right, Eric, tell us about Dr. Sleep.
Okay. Well, this is Stephen King's an adaptation of Stephen King's 2013 sequel to his, you know, many think is his masterpiece, The Shining. The movie begins not too long after the events of the movie, Kubrick's movie. And we'll get to that in a second. Where young Danny is given some advice by none other than Dick Halloran about how to survive sort of deal with the ghosts that are still trying to find him and possess his powers and suck it out of him, basically. And even though he learns to adapt to that as a child, much later on in his adulthood, he has become a very angry alcoholic, as we meet Danny Torrance later on in 2011, now played by Ewan McGregor. That's how we first see him, and he has a pretty quick turnaround at that point where he wants to sober up, so he changes locations and, you know, is kind of isolates himself, but finds work, finds help through a sponsor played by Cliff Curtis, and as he gets himself back to normal, he begins to sort of feel his powers once again, his shining. But meanwhile, across the country, there is a group that is known as the True Knot, which is basically this sort of roving gang of kind of hippie, almost like vampires, if you will, led by Rose the Hat, played by Rebecca Ferguson, who travel throughout the country looking for children who possess the powers such as the Shining, and basically try to suck it out of them, and they do it by killing them because the fear makes their essence that they suck into their bodies and make them basically immortal all the more powerful. All these characters are going to basically come together at some point. There's a 13-year-old girl. This is a movie, flash forwards to 2019. There's a 13-year-old girl who is also dealing with her ability to shine and starts to develop a path to the True Knot, and we're going to see all of these characters eventually collide at some point. And collide is kind of a very interesting word to use for this movie, because people are familiar with the history of Stephen King's book and Stanley Kubrick's adaptation of it. Needless to say, Stephen King was not a fan of that version. They're two different versions of the same story, if you will, both in many ways beloved, sometimes by the same people who read and saw the movie. But King has maintained that Kubrick came up with a much different vision for it, and that's sort of an underlying theme of this movie, of the sort of reconciling the past with the present, and trying to come to terms with reconciling the two. And because Stephen King's book of Dr. Sleep was a direct sequel to his book and not Stanley Kubrick's movie, Mike Flanagan, who adapted and directed this movie, still has to deal with the Kubrick version while still trying to adapt the novel at the same time. So needless to say, he's made a number of changes to the film or to the book. And I having not read the book, I'm just only familiar with the storyline, I think that he's done a pretty terrific job with this film. This is a 2.5-hour movie. I did not know what to make of this movie. There's been so many King adaptations over the years, and some of the more recent ones, particularly the Pet Sematary one, which I know Nick and I very much disagree on, I think didn't understand the themes of that story, where Dr. Sleep, I think, is really trying to get to the heart of it. I don't know if it's always successful at that bridge that I'm talking about. I'll get to that in a second. But just as pure storytelling goes, I think Flanagan has done a pretty masterful job at this. The film is never less than engrossing through the entire way. Rebecca Ferguson kills in this movie, literally and figuratively. Just every time she's on screen, the movie really comes alive. Ewan McGregor, I think, is very good in this movie. Just about, you know, everyone in this movie is very good. It feels like a Stephen King story, and its connections with then bridging the past with the present and ultimately the future leads to some really interesting stuff in the third act of this movie. I think that it might take someone like Charlie Kaufman to really sort of fully bridge that sort of that world between fiction and nonfiction, you know, the way that King and Kubrick kind of dealt with. But it leads to some really, really fun stuff. I mean, the finale of the third act of this movie is really kind of the reward for the audience in going through this. Not that, you know, they've had to suffer through 2 hours, because it's very entertaining. Very entertaining, scary at times, not outright, like, shock horror, but just unsettling, you know, particularly the casting of one of the kids that they kill in the movie, which I surprised the hell out of me, such a small part that was for that actor. And so when we get to the final third of the movie, which leads to this wonderful scene that could very easily be distracting for audiences. In fact, the casting of trying to, again, bridge the 1980 film with this movie, recasting some of those roles could very much be a distraction. Alex Esso as playing Shelley Duvall, playing Wendy, is unbelievable as far as I'm concerned. And who they get, I don't want to say too much, but I'll just say that there's a scene in a bar late in the movie that I think is the best scene in the movie. And it's weird at first, but the interaction between those two characters, I think, really gets to the heart of what this movie is about. I like this movie a lot more than I thought I was going to, and I heartily recommend it.
All right, guys, hang on.
Yes.
All right, Eric and Steve are going to hang on, and when we come back, we'll find out what Steve thought of Dr. Sleep and what I thought of Dr. Sleep right here on WGN. Right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline studio here till 5 on this Monday morning. Eric and Steve talking about the movies. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
Steve, what'd you think of Dr. Sleep?
Oh, it's not only fun and terrific, it's bold. Like, this movie is daring at a couple times. There were probably a half dozen times while I was watching this where I just said, oh, we're going there. We're actually doing this. And once I realized what the almost inevitable final battleground was going to be, which is not the final battleground of the book, I sort of began to imagine the possibilities. And even then, I was still pretty shocked about how far Mike Flanagan pushed the boundaries and made me realize that sometimes things that feel like a degree of fan service might also be the best ideas for the story being told. And my guess is that that point will be debated for some time to come. And I think this film might be kind of divisive, considering how much in certain places he strays from the Dr. Sleep novel. But still, I mean, it's phenomenal. And I thought that the young actress that plays the young girl, the character's name is Abra, and the girl's name is Kylie Curran, and she and McGregor together are these great psychic partners that each kind of bring something unique to the film. Danny is sort of has this sort of quiet desperation because he knows the forces that are at play, whereas Abra doesn't know what she doesn't know. And she's almost, in a way, she's almost afraid of nothing because she doesn't know what there is to be afraid of. And it makes her a little reckless, but she's also, like, maybe the most powerful one of these people that's ever existed. And she's constantly testing her limits, and she doesn't seem to have any, apparently. So The one thing this film isn't, and this isn't even a criticism, is I didn't think it was particularly scary, and I don't think it's designed to be. It's more about, like, Flanagan is going for the sort of sustained tension and impactful atmosphere. There's not a lot of gore except for the scene that Eric referred to earlier. There's a young kid who is viciously murdered, but most of the worst of that is sort of kept off screen. So even although that doesn't really make it any better in a lot of ways, it's a horrifying scene. But yeah, I mean, Mike Flanagan has sort of, like, in a very short time become a really reliable horror filmmaker, just regular filmmaker. He did Gerald's Game a couple years ago, which is a book that a lot of people thought was unfilmable. A lot of people thought Dr. Sleep was unfilmable. And he also did the Netflix series The Haunting of Hill House, which was great. So this is kind of his masterstroke at attempting something that I almost can't believe anyone would have the guts to attempt. And he kind of just took a little from column A and a little from column B, and the result is remarkable and effective and just, like I said, pure and uncut boldness. And it's fascinating to watch him bring both sort of scale and intimacy together, terror and comfort, pain and healing, cold and warmth, like literally and figuratively. And then this is also a kind of an interesting story about addiction and redemption.
That's so, exactly right.
Yeah,
right.
That's a thing that kind of seeps through everything. So yeah, it's bold in a way that a lot of horror films or any films are these days. So I was more than impressed with this.
No, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. Steve, the thing that I connected with on a personal level was this, you know, like, because basically the book The Shining is about alcoholism. And that was and that was what King was going through. He was struggling through his drinking when he wrote this stuff. And that permeates every frame of this movie from the very beginning, obviously. Well, when you first see the kind of shape that Ewan McGregor is in, and then what he has to go through, and that scene in the bar is so strong.
Oh, vicious. It's vicious.
Unbelievable. And you know, it's like those two characters confronting each other, the bottle of Jack Daniels between the two. It destroyed me. It leveled me. I love so much about this movie. God, the little girl is good. Kylie Curran, she's so good. Rebecca Ferguson is unbelievable in this. All the characters are fun, and they have that weird Stephen King character, quote unquote, kind of thing, you know, with the weird names and all that, all that stuff. That's so Stephen King. And yet it pays wonderful tribute to Kubrick's movie. And, you know, like you said, the last third is just wonderful. And especially if you're a fan of the movie of The Shining, and I am, I happen to love that movie, and I know a lot of people do. But I think McGregor's great in it, and it really, I was just, it really, this movie hit me, it leveled me. And so, you know, like the casting of the younger characters, you know, like and then bringing back some of the characters from The Shining, and there's a moment in the movie where you get to see like a lot of the ghosts that haunted The Shining. And that's really a great payoff there. The chemistry between Ewan McGregor and the little girl is fantastic. It is suspenseful. It doesn't feel long. It's 2.5 hours, and it just breezes by as far as I'm concerned. And I was into it from the first frame, and I really liked it overall. And I'm really sad that not many people went to see it. I really think it's a shame, and I think people should see it because it's a really terrific movie. Stephen King likes it.
Yeah, so, he produced it. So
yeah, no, he likes it. So
he paid to like it. But yes,
it's funny that he likes it, considering the last half hour is, you know, pays massive tribute to Kubrick's movie, which he dislikes. But you have to do it that way. You can't make a movie sequel to The Shining and have it be more of a sequel to the book. You have to acknowledge because the movie The Shining is just such a classic.
But I think what Flanagan does that's clearly appeased King so much is that he basically kind of redoes The Shining in the final third of the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, he gives us the ending that King always envisioned for that story, and like you said, the aura of the alcoholism and the redemption and whatnot is what that story was about.
Absolutely.
And that's the arc that he gives to this movie. So, yeah, I mean, he was doing service to King as well as to the audience. And I will just one quick thing I'll just say is that, well, Steve mentioned that, yes, it's very easy to just label that stuff fan service or fan fiction and stuff like that. But this movie rewards its fans not just, you know, as fans of the Shining and the book and the movie, but just in a term of comeuppance. I mean, this movie delivers when everyone, when they start to turn the table on the True Knot. I was like, oh, damn, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a terrific movie, and I would hope that more people go to see it. Great all the way across, and I connect it with it on a personal level too, which is why it was so effective for me. So there you go. All right, next week, what do we got? We got Ford versus Ferrari, right?
Yeah, we got Charlie's Angels.
And the good
Adam Driver double bill report and Marriage Story.
Okay, Marriage Story. Oh boy, Marriage Story next week. Oh boy. All right.
Hang on, Nick.
Yeah, I know. All right. All right, Steve, thanks, man.
Thanks.
Okay, buddy. We'll talk to you next week. Eric, let's go through the box office here. Number one, Midway with 17.5. Not a lot of stuff. Not a lot of good numbers here in general for the box office this week.
No, not at all. And while people are certainly are focusing a lot on what we're going to be talking about at number two right now, I mean, Midway getting number one is like, okay, Lionsgate has a headline for a week that they can say, oh, the number one movie in America and advertised on Veterans Day and stuff. Okay, good for them. But I mentioned during the review, the movie costs $100 million. And it's not exactly a story that's going to have a lot of broad international appeal.
Right.
You know, I mean, I don't know how many times we have to keep fighting this battle, and I don't know, you know, the people who lost certainly don't want to see this battle anymore. So I don't think it's going to do very well internationally, and it's going to have to, because a $17.5 million opening is not good for a $100 million film.
Yeah, yeah. And that just shows you it's number one at the box office, a really slow week.
Yes.
Number two, Dr. Sleep with 14.1 million. I did not expect it to do so poorly. I thought it was going to be a much bigger number.
No, I mean the tracking. I mean, again, the tracking services failed again. Tracking services had this anywhere from like $24 to $30 million at that high, and I thought it was like mid-20s, right around 25. I thought it was a pretty solid number for it where it was going to land up. But I get Warner Brothers has to sort of look themselves in the mirror on this, because horror movies, at least in this millennium, do not sell in November. They just don't. The numbers do not bear it out. The most successful horror movies that have opened in November were from 1999, you know, in the past.
Yeah.
There's not been a horror movie since 2000 that has made more than $60 million in November.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, thought that, like, oh, you know, on opening this movie after Halloween 2, like, they'd have the wrong release date for it. They should have opened it in the summer or in the spring or you know, or before Halloween even, you know, where it probably could have, you know, killed.
Yeah.
But opening in November, and we're in the holiday season now, you know, people, and people weren't crazy about It Chapter 2, a lot of people either.
Right.
So,
All right, number three, Playing with Fire, $12.8 million. That's about where it should be, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
It's a $30 million film, and, you know, Paramount, whatever.
Yeah. number four, Last Christmas, $11.6 million.
I think that ended up being a little bit. I mean, think people were sort of expecting somewhere like $14 to $16 million for that. So that's got to be a little disappointing.
Yeah.
Not a hugely expensive picture, but I can't imagine word of mouth is going to be great on it.
Okay. And then number five is Terminator: Dark Fate, which is just bombing. So.
Ooh, this is. I mean, it's about $200 million worldwide. But this is a movie that needs a $500 million worldwide before it starts talking profit. This
all right.
is a major bomb.
All right. Listen, what are we talking about next week?
Ford versus Ferrari.
Ford versus Ferrari.
Ford versus Ferrari. I don't know if there's a lot of interest in Charlie's Angels.
Yeah.
But I think Ford versus Ferrari is going to be in that $25 to $30 million range we talked about.
Okay, cool. All right, Eric. Thanks, man. We'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
All right. There you go. Eric and Steve, we'll be back next week for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. We're going to take a break right here on WGN.